You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
But what a religion does with suffering, with turbulence, with change. It tells you a lot about the nature of that religion. And whatever religion a society adopts tells you a lot about that society. Two religions, very, very old religions, have been making a growing comeback in our day. The first is Buddhism, and the second is Stoicism. Stoicism is more of a philosophy, but it has at its root a view of the world, and both deal primarily with how do you deal with suffering? How do you deal with pain? So Buddhism begins with the presupposition that how do I eliminate all desire? How do I eliminate all want? Because in those desires, those wants cannot be disappointed, and therefore suffering then can lessen and therefore can end. Stoicism tries to create some sort of strange, superhuman, emotional barrier so that whatever waves crash upon my life, whatever difficulties I face, whatever pain I face, I learn to let it just wash off my shoulders and simply keep moving forward. It's remarkable to me to look out, take a survey of the internet and see the resurgence of a kind of growing appeal to Stoicism, particularly among young men in our country. How do we become emotionally detached from the world around us? How do we become emotionally detached from our own disappointments, from our own pain, from anything that would come at us? Jordan Peterson has exploded in popularity, particularly among young men, but among a whole swath of our population. He is some sort of theist, but at the heart of his philosophy is Stoicism. How do we approach a world that we expect to be marked by trouble, by difficulty, by pain, by hardness, and become the kind of people who are hard enough to be unaffected by that pain, unaffected by those disruptions? The Bible, the Proverbs in particular, holds out to us a different vision of the good life. A different vision of how do we wisely endure and live out a life, in fact, make plans in a world that is absolutely marked by trouble, by pain, by difficulty, by surprises, some of them really good and some of them really bad. The Bible holds out a different vision, either than I'm learning to not want anything, diving into the self such that everything else in the world doesn't affect us, on the one hand with Buddhism, or on the other hand with Stoicism. It offers us something different than the kind of emotional detachment or learning to be hard enough that things don't affect us or move us. It offers a different vision of what it means to live in the midst of a world like that. And it confronts us with the way that most of us think the world works. Yesterday, driving back from Oklahoma, we were with the Wilsons. And I won't say who among our party made this decision, but someone decided that the best plan to be made for how we were going to travel to Oklahoma and back from Oklahoma was to rent a van, a single van, for everyone to ride in. I don't know how many of you have memories of youth group trips or various sorts of things where you all rode in a van. This was very, very similar, like for better or for worse. The one among us who made that decision decided that the best place that we should get this van was a place called uglyvans.com. Now, I don't know what you think of when you hear of uglyvans.com, but it's exactly what you would expect. I was talking to a friend yesterday afternoon as we were broken down on the side of I-70 somewhere in the middle of eastern Colorado. And I said, he asked where we rented the van. I said, uglyvans.com. And he said, well, like, it's exactly what you should have expected. And so driving to Oklahoma, driving to the lake, we found that one of our tires was bulging about to burst and eventually did just collapse. And it had to be towed, so that was one tow trip in about 5 days. And then yesterday, we're driving along, I think we're playing some sort of story game, and suddenly one of the people in the car wisely said, it's overheating, and we had to pull over as the car failed to cool itself. So suddenly this plan to make it to Oklahoma by a certain time and to get back from Oklahoma at a certain time, was completely thwarted and turned upside down by something that anyone who is wise could have seen coming when you have an ugly van. And instead of continuing to tell our story game and continue on the road down I-70 to get to Denver, Colorado, we found ourselves, walking down I-70 to get to a small town that was a mile down the road to get to their diner. Now, this diner was amazing. Silver, reflective, and the key part of this diner that had relatively sub-average chicken fried steak sandwiches, what was it had a real pink Cadillac on a pole directly in front of the diner. Now, here was a plan to be executed, to take our ugly van, to drive it to Oklahoma, to drive it back to Denver, and now that plan is derailed. It's derailed. It's derailed by the fact that the ugly van truly was ugly on the inside and the out, and we couldn't get to where we wanted to go in the time that we wanted to get there. Here was a plan that now we're walking down I-70 instead of driving down I-70. Here's a plan that we wanted to go straight through and kind of get there, get home in a reasonable time by 4 o'clock yesterday. But instead, we are experiencing the glories of the I-70 diner and the pink Cadillac in front of it. And this story, as I was telling everyone yesterday as we're sitting there on the side of I-70, was perfect for this sermon. It's perfect because here's a plan. Here's a plan made. Here's a plan. Take it as a vacation, a trip, just driving home. But extend that out. Here's a career. Here's raising a child. Here's your education, high school. Here's date night. Here's buying a house. Here's finances or health. To take whatever issue it is, and we begin almost always in all of those cases with a plan. Here's how things ought to go. Here's where we should go. Here's how things are going to work. In 3 years, I need to be at this place. In 5 years, at this place. I'm going to have this kind of money set away. Here's where my career needs to be when I get to this point or this place. You start out marriage, beginning with an idea of here's what marriage will look like. Here's how our relationship will progress. Here's how we'll start building a family and putting down roots and living in a place. And then the engine goes out, or the tire starts bulging in a really strange place, in a really strange way, and vibrating the whole car. And next thing you know, you're walking down I-70 and you're staring at a pink Cadillac and trying to order a chicken fried steak sandwich. I mean, this is the reality of our experience of the world. This is why things like Stoicism and Buddhism have seemingly such appeal. How do you deal with a life that seems to throw everything at you? That seems to almost chaotically disrupt every plan you set in motion? We tend to think and approach the world as if we're sovereign over it. We can control our lives. We can manage our schedules. We can make sure that the noon meeting stays at noon tomorrow. We can ensure that the budget progresses and builds the way it should be. We can make sure that our finances get to where it needs to be in order for us to get to enter into retirement at a reasonable age. We approach life as though we're sovereign. And the reality is that we're constantly confronted with the reality that we're not sovereign over a minute or an hour of our day, let alone the whole course of a career or the whole course of a marriage. We're confronted with the realities that we make plans all the time. We have to, or nothing would happen. And yet those plans often turn to dust in our hands and become something completely different, sometimes for better and oftentimes for worse. How do we navigate a world like that? Are we simply to kind of go through life with a constant series of disappointments? I'm not getting what I want. My life isn't kind of playing itself out the way I envisioned it, the way I wrote it down in my focus journal. These people keep changing the schedule. My wife's sick. How do we navigate that kind of world? Always in danger of presuming to be sovereign. And at the next moment, feeling this tension, this weight of, what am I doing even making plans anyway? They never work out. How do we live in the midst of a world like that? And in light of that, we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 16. I mean, how it actually describes for us a world different than the one that we think we live in. And so, how does the world actually work? I want to look at three verses in this chapter that kind of lay out for us a different sense of how the world is than maybe the ways that we presume that the world is. One, everything has a purpose. Look at verse 4. The Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. And so at the heart of this proverb is this deep underlying assumption that the God of the universe has ordered the world to work in a certain way, but not in kind of a naturalistic sense, not in a sense that he is kind of a distant watchmaker, kind of setting the timer and then things just play out naturally, but no, a God who is actually active in the midst of the world, active in the midst of your life, ordering it step by step by step. The beauty of the reality that verse 33 says that the tossing of dice, that this kind of game that's laid out in verse 33 of like, how are we going to cast a lot? Nobody's completely sure what it means to cast a lot, but it was some game of chance that was a way decisions would be made. So it's kind of like flipping a coin, rolling the dice. And here the author of Proverbs says that that's not chance. The God of the universe, the decision for what's even going to come out of the flipping of a coin or the rolling of dice, it's given by God. He says that every step, verse 9, is established by God. And so here's a world that we presume often to think that we are sovereign over. We are ruling over. I will go do this. This is how my life will work. This is how my body is going to function. This is what my marriage is going to look like. These are the plans I'm going to make. And at the heart of Proverbs 16 is a vision of a God who is not distant, but is intimately and sovereignly and providentially involved in every roll of the dice, in every overheating engine, in every step that is taken. It is established by the Lord. Here's a vision of God who is pervasively sovereign, who is not distant, who's not just kind of overseeing the plans that you're making over where you hope to be in 20 years. He's not just there saying, trying to provide some moral guidance over what your life should look like. But God who is intimately, deeply involved, deeply attentive to every single step your life takes. I don't know what your relationship with your father is like. But the Father portrayed for us, given to us in the Scriptures, is a God who doesn't just kind of set us with a direction and kind of send us on our way. But here is a Father who is attentive to every step, attentive to every blown out tire, attentive to every decision, every roll of the dice, every flip of the coin, every word that is spoken, every decision that is made, establishing it or turning it. And so The scriptures present to us a vision of life, a vision of what it means to make plans in this life that begins with one fundamental presupposition that should guide, should ground, should root us as we think about every decision we make, every plan that is set in motion. Our God establishes every single step, not just trajectories, not just morality, but where and how you should go and how it's going to go in the end. This is how the world actually works. In other words, it is not chaos. Not one part of it. It is ruled by a God who establishes steps, controls the lots, establishes every single moment, attentive to all of it. This is the nature of the world that we live in. And learning to be the kind of people that make plans in light of that world is a different sort of thing. One of my favorite books by C.S. Lewis is a book called Paralandra. And in Paralandra, there is the Green Lady, for those of you who read it. The Green Lady is the Eve figure in this story. And a man has been sent from Earth to help kind of steer the early parts of the creation of this, it's Venus, of what's happening on this planet. And we see kind of unfold this this ongoing and very interesting conversation between this man who's experienced disappointment, this man who's experienced brokenness and sin in life. And he's having a conversation with this woman. And the kind of key image from the planet is that the whole thing is sea. It's ocean. And so you ride these islands that kind of go with the waves. And he's talking to her about the nature of disappointment and asking her if she is disappointed. Her husband's Adam has been gone for a little while now, and she's hasn't seen him for several days. And so he's trying to get at the concept of disappointment, that there's something that she should want that she's not getting, that she would want to be with Adam. She'd want to be with her husband, and yet her husband isn't there. And so the ransom, talking to the green woman, begins to talk to her about, hey, so you the waves that are coming towards you, these gifts that God is giving you, there's something that he's withholding from you. There's a good that he's not giving you that you should want. And there's this beautiful response to ransom from the green woman in saying, essentially saying, it would be a remarkably miserable life. That instead of receiving the good that God has given you now, to constantly be thinking of or anticipating or wanting the good that he has withheld. To spend a life longing for the thing that God hasn't given you rather than embracing and receiving the gift that God has given you. And this is a remarkable insight into how do we live in a world where God is pervasively sovereign. The response to a blown out engine yesterday could be marked by rage, anger, frustration. It's hot. We need to get back. But here is a pink Cadillac and a chicken fried steak sandwich. The good that God had provided, the good that God had given, the adventure of getting to take a nice picture of the van on the side of the road with the hood up, steaming slightly. We live in a world in which God turns our steps this way and that, and we think we're headed to that door, and the next thing we know, we're going out that door. And this is the great truth at the bottom of this. Our God gives us goods, and they are often, maybe more often than not the good we were seeking, but the good he has provided. And we have to learn, as the people of God, what does it mean to receive from our Father the good he gives and not the good he withholds. And it's a good thing. In verse... No, I lost it. In verse 25... There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death. The reality is that this is profoundly good news. The realization that you're not sovereign over your schedule tomorrow, you're not sovereign over your career, you're not sovereign over the health of your own body is glorious, marvelous good news because of verse 25. Verse 25 says that there is a way that seems right to man. There's a way that seems right to you and I. There's a way that if I could map out my life, the way that I would want it to go, the way that I would long for it to be, the way that I would want our finances to go and my career to go and our relationships to go and my health to go and my children's lives to go, there's a way that would seem right to me. The author of Proverbs gives us a brilliant insight into the reality of wise living in the world. The way that seems right to you will kill you. We make plans all the time looking inward, confident in our own abilities, confident in our own plans, confident in our own sense of what is right and wrong and good. Not listening to the voice of God, not listening to the directions of God. And our ways will kill us. Our ways will destroy us. Our ways will lead us to death. And so it is profoundly good news that as we set out on the way over and over and over again, that the Lord, our Father, our covenant God, He's the one who establishes our steps, not us. And so we live in a world ruled by God. We take steps and make plans. And Proverbs encourages us to do that. We'll talk about that in a second. But as we do so, we live as people not confident in our own abilities, not confident in our ability to sovereignly fulfill our own plans, but deeply aware of the reality that it is God who rules my days. As the author of James says in the text that we read before, our text in Proverbs 16, if the Lord wills, I'll go do this and that. So how do we make plans in a world ruled by God? How do we make plans and plan for the future? How do we schedule our days when God sovereignly rules our days, rules our hours, rules our steps? I want to draw out a couple of things in this text as we look at that. First, verse 8. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. Establish in your heart to walk in accordance with the righteousness of God. To listen to Him and how He instructs us, how He leads us, how He tells us we ought to live. Obey His word. Above all, be a man or a woman who is committed to listening to submitting to obeying all that God has commanded us to do, to seek above all else, above wealth, above tranquility in life, above your career going where it ought to go, above all else, seek to do all that God commands us. Obey His righteousness above all else. Verse 20. Whoever gives thought to the word, this can be translated matter or issue or the idea, will discover good. And blessed is he who trusts in the Lord. There's a kind of two ideas pulled together and held together by this verse. One is the idea that you should give thought to the matter. You should give thought to where your life is going to go. You should think about things like planning and budgeting and scheduling and ordering your life in a certain way and planning out your career and planning out vacations and figuring out the details, the mundane details of your life and making plans. You should give thought to that. One reaction to hearing of a pervasively sovereign God who establishes our steps could be to kind of throw up our hands and say, I'm just going to fly by the seat of my pants. God's going to do what He's going to do anyway, right? The Bible actually confronts us and calls us in the face of that precious reality to live very differently than that. To give intentional thought to how we will live our days. To give intentional thought to making plans, to making schedules. It commands us to make plans and to be intentional with how we think about our own bodies and our own lives and our calendars and our schedules and our budgets and our finances and our health. To approach those things as those who are not just haphazardly flying through life, because God's sovereign anyway, but in the light of his sovereignty, in the light of his pervasive rule over every step we take, be diligent to steward all of it well. If God is attendant to every step of your life, you should be attendant to every step of your life. But in the light of that, he pulls together here into verse 20, this idea of, yes, make your plans. Yes, give thought to the matter. Be diligent in thinking about each step and how your life should go. And in the end, the posture is entrust the Lord. I make plans and I trust him. I may intend to go left. I have a million reasons for why I ought to go left. And yet, for whatever reason, the course of my life may go right. In that moment, an arrogant heart, as described in this chapter, resists, is angry, throws up his hands in frustration. Because my plans didn't work out. A heart that trusts the Lord receives the good he intends to give us and not the good we haven't received. We receive from his hand all his gifts. So be diligent. Make your plans. Oh, but trust the Lord. Trust the Lord always. And last, look over to me at verse 3. It says here, commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. And this feels to us as we read it like a formula. Like if I'll just do whatever commit says, then the plans I've made will be established. The way I want things to work out will work out. But that's where this verse kind of throws us for a loop, and particularly this word commit. The word commit here it carries this meaning, this idea of it's what you do with a sacrifice on an altar. So you get what the author is saying. Oh, make your plans and then hand them to God and let him have his way with them. Oh, make your plans. Be diligent in thinking on a thing and how you want a thing to go and where you want your life to go. But in the end, you lay them on an altar before God and you commit them to him, you dedicate them to him, you give them to him, trusting in what he's going to do with those plans, trusting in the course he's going to give you for your life. Now this is all well and good if we're talking about budgets and calendars and what do you do for lunch tomorrow? But here's the reality. Is that sometimes the kind of disruptions we're talking about, that you are called and commanded, that we're called and commanded in this text to trust the Lord with, is pain and loss. There's some in this room actually who are enduring massive disruptions to their life. And those disruptions are painful. Those disruptions are marked by death, the death of someone you intended to walk with much, much longer than you got to. For some of you, it's been sickness, illness, a kind of loss of a sort of vibrancy of life you expected to have. And here's where this text comes and comforts in a way that Stoicism never will. That gives you permission to engage that pain in a way that Buddhism never gives you permission to engage it. Pain and loss is real. It hurts. But the glory of it all is that in your pain, God is doing 1,000 things. 1,000 good things. 1,000 even glorious things. Marvelous things. Most of which maybe some, for many of you, none of which you'll be able to name or identify. And here's the thing, the command of trusting God in the midst of disrupted plans, even massively painful, devastating changes in plans, God ordering your steps in ways and leading you to a place that you never wanted to go. It does not require you, this kind of trust does not require you to be able to name the reasons why God has taken you right rather than left. It does not require you to name the reasons why you've had to suffer this kind of loss. He's led you into this dark valley, this painful season. It requires you to trust that our Father is not haphazard. He's not random. He isn't vain. He's not just beating at the wind, just seeing how you'll respond. As he says in this chapter, like, everything has a purpose, even the wicked man in the day of trouble. And so the call of this text is not, you have to explain, here's exactly what God is up to in my pain. And please, for those of you offering counsel to those who are enduring massive disruptions in their plans and their lives and their marriages and their health, the call of God for you is not a call to come alongside them and explain to them the meaning of their suffering, to explain to them why it is that maybe 10 of the thousands of reasons why God has ordered their life this way. Instead, it is to come alongside them and with them, maybe in times even for them, to trust in a God who orders our steps. There's this wonderful line in Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31 is it's a mom writing to her son. And the back part of Proverbs 31 is famously describes the sort of woman he should pray for and seek as a wife. And one of the lines describing this woman is that she laughs at the days to come. And we spent some time in the van yesterday talking about my mom. And my mom passed away a few years ago. And there was a season of our life, I was the only son, a season of our life when my father was very, very sick and was headed towards death. One of the darkest seasons imaginable for a woman who loved her husband very much and whose husband was very, very, very sick. And what I remember most of that season, I remember the darkness, I remember the pain, I remember the tears, but I remember laughter. I've never known a woman who laughed like her. In the face of ferocious pain and darkness, she laughed more than anyone I know. And it wasn't a dismissive laugh. It wasn't a kind of a cold-hearted laugh. It was a laugh marked by tears. It was a laugh marked by suffering. It was a laugh marked by enormous amounts of pain. But it was a laugh who couldn't explain to you why God was doing what God was doing, couldn't explain to you all the reasons why suffering was perhaps producing good, couldn't explain to you all the directions that God was taking our family in this season that felt like absolute and utter chaos. But in the root of it all, she would say again and again and again, I trust him. Here's the marvelous fact about our God. Whether he leads you into dark seasons of suffering and loss, he leads you to places you never thought you would find yourself, he is always up to something different than you and I are. Something bigger, something far more glorious and beautiful and often painful than we would ever choose. But he is at work in our plans, redirecting them, disrupting them. Oh, he loves to mess with your schedule. But you can trust him. And in that trust, you can laugh. You can enjoy a sub-average chicken fried steak sandwich. And try to snap good pictures of a pink Cadillac hanging over I-70. I'm going to take us to one last place as we end. How do we do that? Because if we're honest, like, I don't trust anyone with my plans as much as I trust myself with my plans, right? The arrogant heart described in this text over and over and over again, it doesn't really matter how hard I fight it. That's just always true. Default condition of our hearts is I know better. I know what my life should look like. I know what this church should look like. I know what my family should look like. I know what our finances should look like. I know what my health should look like and my kids' health should look like. I presume to know exactly the best way. And this text calls me, commands me, yes, make plans. Yes, set out a course for your life. And then every step when it's disrupted, every step when it's turned this way or that, trust in the Lord. Trust him. How do I do that? There's this wonderful text right smack dab in the middle of this whole section. Which God commands us, he calls us. So what does it look to trust him? Listen to verse 6. How do we trust him? By steadfast covenant love and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for. By the fear of the Lord, one turns away from evil. I don't want to trust God with anything. I want control of my own life, my own schedule, my own plans, all of it. How will I ever become the kind of person who trusts in the Lord, who hands him those plans, who commits those plans to him? To trust that he's way smarter than I am. I don't think it's merely from the intellectual assent that if there's a God, he's smarter than I am. I think it begins here with steadfast love. Each week we end at this table with bread and with wine and water. Constant reminders, more than that, tastes, the stunning reality of God's covenant love, his steadfast love. That he's not only smart, he's absolutely smart. He's not only way wiser than you and I are, he's also, he's up to far grander and better things than we could ever imagine or hope for. Deeper things, different things, yes, he's all of those things. But here's the precious reality. Not only is he sovereign, not only is he wise, he loves you. Like, your pain isn't arbitrary. Your disrupted plans are not just on a whim. Here's a sovereign God, a good God, a wise God, who bears for you steadfast love that atones for your sin, steadfast love that washes you of your sin. Steadfast love that does not hold your sins against you, so that none of those pains, none of those disruptions are punishment for sin. They're the leading of a sovereign and wise Father who has dealt with your sins in the body and blood of Jesus and leads you even as you make your plans. Let's pray.